Just out of curiosity, can anybody remember what we covered last Wednesday night if you were here? Got some of them nodding their heads, but I need to hear it. What did we cover? Age of the Earth, yes. Thank you, from the back row, as it were. We talk about young people interested in how do you teach a professor in college who is trying to convince you that because of the millions and billions of years that he says it took to develop the earth, how do you harmonize that with God? And these professors are basically saying you can't believe in God and believe science. And did I tell you it was Matthew Franks that actually brought this up at camp at Birmingham Southern? And his professor in Introductory to Philosophy began to stress this agnostic, atheistic position. You can't believe a 6,000-year young earth and the fact that science argues, or I would call pseudoscience, argues that it's millions and billions of years old. I'm not going to go back through that. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, David, can you tell me, is it recorded even every class, even Wednesday night classes? Okay. On our website, we have capability now, if you have internet access, to pull up all the audio from this auditorium class. And so last Wednesday night's lesson is actually on the website. So if anybody is interested in, you know, getting a copy of it, we can make copies, but really can just pull it up on the internet. Let me just run through the topics. I didn't do this the last time, I don't believe. I just talked about one of them that the young people wanted brought up because they're really curious about a lot of different things. One particular student wanted to know, how can you verify the validity of the truth about the church? And what they meant by that was, how can you know that you're in the right church? That's as simple as I know how to make it. And the idea is, there's a lot of different churches out here, but how can you know that you're in the right church? And how, also as a sidelight to that, which was in another question, how can you convince somebody who believes they're in the right church what the right church is if they're not in the right church? And so it had to do basically with the identity of the church and taking the Bible and knowing how to teach somebody else the truth about the Bible and in turn convincing yourself. The other night when I was teaching class, actually it was last night, I was in Boaz, Alabama, at Crestview Church of Christ teaching class, School of Bible Emphasis classes that's at Hobbs Street, also is in four other locations in the southeast, and last night I had to go to Boaz. A man was talking about how that he was studying with another man at work, and because this man didn't believe the same thing as he believed, it forced him to have to study his Bible, not just to convince his friend what the Bible says, but to reassure himself that he was right. And if you don't study your Bible for yourself, you're basically taking somebody's word for it. And he said it was a challenge. He says, my faith has grown tremendously. And I said, well, that's how it works. Because when you study the Bible, like you may hear me preach or teach, here's what the Bible says, and you look up the verse. If you don't study all that out in your mind to put all the pieces together, you're basically just taking what I'm telling you. And look at the religious world. Do people just take at face value whatever their preacher tells them and don't study it out? And they got all the confidence in the world in their speaker, their preacher, whatever, his education and so forth. And it creates a problem because they're trusting in the preacher and they're not trusting in their Bible because they don't know their Bible. This morning in class, the Wednesday morning class, by the way, we're discussing discipline today and actually a study of self-discipline. And last week we talked a little bit about that. And today we talked about this Adrian Peterson case that's come up. By the way, how many of you don't even know what I'm talking about? Okay, very good then. We're pretty informed here. You know, he's being tried criminally for child abuse, for evidently spanking his child in some kind of situation, whether it was over the edge or, you know, over the top, or actually it was just what you and I probably would have got when we were kids. But we're living in a society to where young people can call 911 on you and the police come up and arrest you if that child accuses you of abusing them. I was listening to a talk show or a radio show on the radio yesterday when I was driving back and forth, and maybe even today even, because this is the big topic right now on sports radio and on talk show radio. And this man, he didn't live in California, but he used to. And he said, in the state of California, in the education system, young people are taught how to call 911 to report anything that disturbs them, whether it be at home, at school, from home to school and back, or in any situation. Here's what you do if something's going on. You just dial 911 and the police will come to your rescue. And I pulled up on a website today. In 2011, there was a newspaper out in California that said there was a teacher who basically, to get the attention of the students, took the table and shook it, rattled it. And there was an eighth grader in that classroom that had their phone and they dialed 911 because they felt threatened. And the police came to the school. Okay? And according to the news report, by the way, it was the Huffington Post out of California, the news report was the teacher was put on leave of absence because since the child called the police and the police came, it had to be investigated. And all the teacher did was the kids weren't paying attention and the teacher just moved the desk and made a noise. Immediately 911's called because I think that's a threatening thing. And the teacher gets leave. By the way, I'm not telling any of you teachers, you want a day off of work for however long, just rattle your desk or whatever you can. Throw a bunch of pencils in the air. I don't know. But this is the world we're living in. This is the society that we're living in. Okay? And the idea is, you know, children have rights. Well, these young people, they want to know how to answer a lot of the questions that you and I've had to deal with all our lives, particularly our religious neighbors that don't believe, you know, what we believe in the Bible. Another question was, dealing with agnosticism again, how do you convince an agnostic that the Bible is not a fairy tale book? In other words, to an agnostic, none of these miracles ever happened. They're just good stories that the Jews put in there. And the Christians started swallowing that, like Jonah being swallowed by a great fish and worldwide flood and fire coming down from heaven and consuming the water on Mount Carmel as much as the sacrifice. So, well, that's just fairy tale. That's Walt Disney. And that's what the agnostic teacher is basically telling these kids. You can't believe your Bible and believe fact. Another child or another student said, I've got a friend who doesn't want to go to church. And because I want this friend to go to church, at least go to church with me, I'm having trouble because the parents of this child don't go to church anywhere. So how do you convince your friend to go to church when the parents of your friend don't even go to church? Okay, by the way, is that a problem? Can that create an environment that's difficult for you to get your friend to go to church when they weren't raised to go to church? By the way, how many of you have ever heard anybody make the statement, well, I wasn't raised to be a church-going person. That's why I don't go to church. That's why I don't go to seminary. I wasn't raised that way. I was raised to stay home on Sunday. The idea of coming to a Bible study on Wednesday night and doing that every Wednesday night, well, man, we didn't do that. I'll tell you something. I know some people in churches of Christ who were taught and trained not to come regularly on a Wednesday night Bible class. Don't y'all? Don't y'all? Come on, shake or nod. Y'all are asleep already, you know. Okay. How many of you know of people in the church who believe all I have to do is show up one time for an hour on Sunday, and particularly Sunday morning, And that's all I have to do to fulfill my obligation to God. Raise your hand if you know somebody that believes that. Raise it high so everybody can see it. Okay? Matter of fact, I was raised in the church, okay, like several of you probably were. But it never dawned on me what I'm going to do on Sunday morning. It never dawned on me what I'm going to do on Sunday night. And it never dawned on me what I'm going to do on Wednesday night. I never had to ask that question because I knew what I was doing. I knew what I was doing whether I was at home or whether I was on vacation. I knew what I was going to be doing. Okay? And let me tell you something. I don't regret a minute of it. Okay? Can you imagine eating one meal on Sunday and that lasting you all the way to the next Sunday? One meal. Okay. How many of you would just be thinking about eating on Monday? And then you'd be starving to death on Tuesday, right? But no, I don't need but one meal a week. Okay. By the way, you could lose a lot of weight that way, right? Okay. But a lot of people only get one spiritual meal a week. Because I am assuming if they don't have any interest in Bible study and they don't have any interest in more than, you know, getting together and singing and praying and studying and so forth, I'm sure they're studying their Bible at home, right? I mean, they're just feeding right and left on all of this at home, so they don't need what we're doing here. I want to tell you something. My track record of what I've experienced of that kind of people is they're not reading their Bible at home. They're not reading this, because if they read this, they would want to be wherever this is studied with opportunities like this. Okay. And so here you've got a young person. How do I get my friend to go to church? My friend's parents don't even go anywhere. Okay. And the mindset of the child is, if it's good enough for my parents, it's good enough for me. Okay. Another one brought up the point about how do you deal with lukewarm Christians? Now listen, here's a teenager, or maybe in their 20s. I think you could be 20. But not 21 because your grandfather out. Here is a high school or first year college who says, I'm disturbed about members of the church that are simply lukewarm in their Christianity. I mean, I can take it or I can leave it. He says, I'm disturbed about people thinking that that's Christianity. And I thought, wow, I'm not the only one that thinks that this is a problem. Okay? And by the way, if you were going to bring up a study of lukewarm, where would you go in the Bible? Where would you go? I'd go to Revelation 3, wouldn't you? Okay? What church do you know was lukewarm in the seven churches of Asia? Anybody? Laodicea, right? And the Lord was just thrilled to death that they were lukewarm. No, I wish that you were cold or hot. In other words, it's better to be dead cold, God said, than to be lukewarm. Now explain that to me. Why is it better to be ice cold as a Christian than to simply be lukewarm? All right, I'm going to give you all time to think about that. We'll come back to that next week, Lord willing. All right, let me give you another one. How do you deal with the question of instrumental music in Psalm 150? Because the Old Testament said, use it. Matter of fact, commanded them to use it. So when you're answering someone that says, why don't you have mechanical instrument music, and they bring up Psalm 150, how do you answer that? Anybody in here know how to answer that? It's Old Testament. Sure. Okay. Well, how do you convince the fact that we're not in the Old Testament? Because I've been preaching out of the Old Testament all Sunday morning for years, right? Or for Sundays, not years. Been preaching on Elijah, right? Okay. If we're not under the Old Testament, why am I preaching out of the Old Testament? Yes. Of course, you're a preacher. You should know the answer. Okay. But I'm talking about you guys, okay? And these kids are not preachers. None of these kids are preachers. Well, I take that back. One is Ben Hogan, okay? Matter of fact, he's the one that won the Bible award for my class because the kid is just a sponge of anything you could teach him. And he's done youth work, and he worked over at Duluth, Georgia, with the Buford Church of Christ as an intern, and has done some preaching. Now, actually, he's at Freed Hardeman right now. He's a Bible major. Here's another thing the kids brought up. What in the world do you do with praise teams? Praise teams. What's a praise team? What is that? Yeah. How many of you have ever visited a congregation where they got microphones dropped out of the ceiling at certain strategic places? Y'all seen that? Anybody? Raise your hand if you've seen that. Okay. And what's the purpose of these microphones being dropped right down these strategic places? Because you got certain people seated under those microphones. What kind of people have you got? Somebody can't carry a tune in the bucket, right? No, that's not why they're dropping that microphone on that person. They're finding the best soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and that's coming out over the PA system. That step leads to they're all standing up here singing what's called special music. What you got is a choir. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, how many of y'all have never heard of praise teams? Raise your hand. Be honest. Never heard of praise teams. Well, let me tell you something. These kids know it. They know what they are. Okay? As a matter of fact, there's some congregations in Huntsville are doing this. There's some congregations in Florence are doing this. Okay, now, folks, I'm not talking about the denominations that have choirs. I'm talking about members of the Lord's church in America are doing this. And these kids won't know what's going on here. Okay? By the way, don't think for a minute that their generation... Listen, that their generation doesn't like that. That generation does like that. How many of y'all have been to a youth rally? Any of y'all ever gone to a youth rally these days? You know what's going on at a youth rally? It ain't congregational singing totally. You've got special groups up here that are singing, and the kids are just out there listening. It's like a concert. By the way, entertainment has pretty much become the new norm in worship services, particularly among the contemporary church. Okay? How many of y'all ever seen the sign on a marquee of a building? It says, contemporary worship service, this time, traditional, this time. How many of y'all even know what that means? Y'all know what that means? For example, what are we having of those two words? What is ours? Traditional. That's what ours is. Okay? Well, who in the world is the contemporary for? Who's it for? It's for the kids. Well, let me ask you a question. If the Lord don't come back in our lifetime, are the kids going to become us, the adults? Are they going to become us? And pray tell me in 40 years, now what you're going to see in the church? I like the contemporary worship. And by the way, if elderships don't know the difference, that's what's going to be in your congregations. Traditional will be out, and contemporary will be in. That's what's happening. By the way, I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I don't think it takes a Solomon to figure that out. Yeah, Benji? Oh, yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, it doesn't have a lot of... Tim's got... Just raise your hand, by the way. Tim's got the microphone down here in the middle. Sort of strategically, but Benji's in the back of the building. But I could hear you. I think everybody else could hear you. Anyway, let me move on. Yo. He's talking about... Yes. Oh, no question. It was modern. It was modern in that day. As a matter of fact, New Testament worship was built out of an appreciation for the God of the Old Testament, which is the true God, by the way. There's no New Testament and Old Testament God. It's the same God. But the worship service radically changed. For example, you change from Saturday to Sunday. you changed the day automatically, right? Okay. You went from feast of meals like Passover, Feast of Tabernacles, to the Lord's Supper. You went to this. By the way, they never took the Lord's Supper under the law of Moses. Never. And all of a sudden, you're now taught as a New Testament Christian, you're not to do the Old Testament practice anymore. You're to do this. Do you not think that would be strange to them? Well, we've never done that before in our life. Our mom and daddy never knew that. Where is the authority for taking these feasts out and putting this in? The apostles' doctrine is what authorized it, right? Okay. The Levites under the law of Moses, those were the ones that were the singers at the temple. The Levites. Why don't you have praise teams, singers for the congregation like they had in the Old Testament? Because the New Testament authorizes what? Teaching and admonishing one another, which is reciprocal. That's why you have congregational singing and you don't have a small group singing to an audience. I mean, there's perfectly good reasons why we do what we do and why we don't do what we don't do. But these kids want to know. I mean, they don't want to just be told this is right and this is wrong. They want to know. They want to be taught as to why we do what we do so that they can share it with friends. David, you had your hand up. Sure. Right. Yeah. Here's another thing they didn't bring up, but I thought it would probably come up, and it didn't come out vocally. How many are familiar with a vocal band? Vocal band. In other words, you don't have the mechanical instruments. You make the sounds of a mechanical sound with your mouth, like an oompa, or the beat, or whatever. In other words, here's people, and they're doing the beat, and then here's a person singing the solo part of that song, and it says, well, we don't have any mechanical instrument, but you're making the sound of it. What is the command of music in the church? It's a four-letter word. S-I-N-G. That is the command in the New Testament. S-I-N-G. Now, what is necessary in order to have S-I-N-G? The answer is words. That's the answer. It's words. By the way, humming is a musical sound, is it not? But it doesn't S-I-N-G. There's no words in that. By the way, how do you teach and admonish? By simply making a sound. If you don't have words, you're not teaching anything except, you know, tickling the ear of the sound. Okay? By the way, let me give you this point. I will never make the argument. I know I have in the past, but I think there's a major flaw with what I'm about to say. I will never make the argument that instrumental music damages vocal singing. I will never make that argument for a couple of reasons. Number one, if mechanical instrument music damages or hinders vocal singing, what are you going to do with it in the Old Testament? Because God commanded it. Does everybody understand what I just said? Come on, I need to see this. Okay? If God authorized instrumental music in the Old Testament along with the Levite singing, did the instrumental music in the Old Testament damage the Levitical singing? That answer is no. Because if it damaged it, God wouldn't have authorized it. I will never make that argument ever again. Because let me tell you something. A person that sees what I just showed you will beat you over the head with that argument. Does everybody see it? Come on. All the way to Aaron Taylor in the back. Does everybody see this? Okay. Yeah. Number two. How many of you enjoy instrumental music along with singing? How many of you get something out of the singing when an instrument is also played that's a secular song? Come on. I do. So the instrument of music doesn't damage a secular song, does it? Oh, come on, you Alabama fans, when they play Roll Tide down there in Bryant-Denny, that don't stir your blood. That don't stir your blood? Absolutely it does. As a matter of fact, you probably got it as your ringtone on your phone. Don't tell me instrumental music don't stir your blood. It does. And Auburn fans in Tennessee and whoever else is in here. And you put the words with it, it just makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, don't it? Don't tell me instrumental music doesn't encourage the enhancing of words. It does. It did it in the Old Testament. God authorized it in the Old Testament. Now the question is, where did God authorize it in the New? And the answer is, God didn't. He told us what He wanted, and that's what I'm to offer. God changed feast. God put in the Lord's Supper. God changed the music in the Old Testament, and He said the instrument you use with music is the H-E-A-R-T. Make melody in your heart. Not harp. Heart. And that's why we don't use mechanical instrument music, because it has to do with authority. By the way, I like instrumental music, don't y'all? Matter of fact, I don't just like it, I love it. But I love a lot of things, but I'm going to have it in a worship service. Because it has to do with authority. Okay? And these kids want to know. By the way, your kids want to know. Okay? Give you another one. Of course, one of the major ones that comes up among that group is peer pressure. How do you handle our peers trying to get us to do this or not do this? Well, by the way, anybody in this room as an adult still got pressure? Peer pressure? You can have it on your job, can't you? Here, you're supposed to take a client out for a power lunch. By the way, your client drinks. And you make sure that he's happy when he comes away from that power lunch. That means, though you don't drink, you make sure he gets what he wants. Any of y'all ever had to been in that situation? Raise your hand. It would surprise me if half this room had not been in that situation if you got anything to do with business and money. By the way, alcohol is the number one drug in this world. I didn't say in this country, in this world. Okay? Another one. How do you talk to people on how to obey the gospel? How do you teach a person how to become a Christian? This is teenagers now. How do I teach somebody how to obey the gospel? Well, number one, you've obeyed the gospel, right? Teach them what you did to become a Christian. Show them in the Bible why it is you did what you did. By the way, I'm going to come back to that one anyway. Another one, how do you talk to your family that's not interested in the church? In other words, here's some of these kids who've got family, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins, brother, sister, whatever the case might be, and they don't want to go to church, but these kids want to go to church. How do I talk to my own family to get them to be church family? By the way, is that a universal problem we've got in every local congregation? Y'all got family members that don't go to church anywhere? Or don't go to the church? How do you deal with it? Makes for good holidays, don't it? Makes for good birthday parties, don't it? Particularly if you're having this family get-together on a Sunday, right? By the way, let me tell you generally how we do that. If I've got a family member, and I do, Phyllis does, if I've got a family member who is not faithful in the church or who is not a Christian, and you're around them, if you want to maintain peace, you talk about every subject under the sun except, bingo, except the topic. For as soon as you bring the topic up, everybody might as well go home. Shake or nod. We can talk about everything known to man, the weather, the Braves, whatever. But don't you ever bring that subject up. Because you bring that subject up, party's over. That's Christmas. That's birthdays. That's family reunions. It's pretty much any kind of social family activity. Just don't bring that subject up. And these kids want to know, how do you solve that problem?
You think that's a pretty good question?
I think it's the $10 million question, to be honest with you, and they want to know. How do you deal with homosexuality? Did y'all know that is now becoming the hot-button topic among this generation? How do you deal with it? Celebrities are coming out of closet everywhere, known to man. Football players, y'all know Michael Sam. Played for Missouri last year. By the way, what is his claim to fame now? Besides the fact that he got drafted. What's his claim to fame? First openly gay NFL player to ever be drafted. By the way, that's something to be proud about, right? To go down in history. Okay? And, by the way, do you think that's created a problem in the NFL? Already has, right? Even the news media brings it out. How do you answer the question of once saved, always saved? By the way, that was Steve Ferguson's question back some time ago when we were doing this. How do you answer the question of once saved, always saved? By the way, how many, raise your hand if you've got relatives that believe that doctrine. Okay? How do you convince somebody that that doctrine's not true? Because let me tell you, the doctrine of once saved, always saved, if you buy into that, is a very comforting doctrine, isn't it? And once a person gets comfortable with that doctrine, it's real hard to get a person to come out of something that they believe is the most comforting thing to think about. By the way, how many of y'all ever heard a preacher at a funeral of a person who died as the biggest renegade of the neighborhood get up and make the statement at the funeral? Now, years ago, this person, when they were very, very young, gave their life to the Lord and trusted Christ as their Lord and Savior. And I'm here to tell the family, while that person hadn't gone to the church building probably decades, they're in the sweet arms of Jesus. How many of y'all have heard anybody say that? Okay. Now, why would they say that? Because they believe the doctrine of once saved, always saved. That's what they believe. And that's why they would say that. Okay. By the way, it is the fifth element of rank Calvinism. Okay. And by the way, don't think there's not some in church, the churches of Christ, that may not believe that doctrine. Because neo-Calvinism is a part of a lot of people's thinking. How do you deal with the problem of gambling? Are y'all familiar with the guy that's going to run against Governor Bentley? What's his name? Yeah, Griffin. You know what his big platform is to run against Parker Griffin? You know what his big platform is right now against Bentley? Education lottery. Not just the lottery. The education lottery. When we lived in Georgia, they were pushing the lottery. By the way, the state of Georgia has it now. But I remember Dad having to get on the radio program and writing articles. And Dad used to say, I would rather my child go to school in a one-room schoolhouse with a dirt floor to get an education than ever to have my child in the finest facility money can buy, and it's all funded by the losers of the lottery. By the way, you throw money at the education problem all you want to. You know how you solve the education problem? If kids want an education, they'll pay whatever price they want to get an education. Let me explain to you something about education. I know this isn't in the Bible. This also has a tie-in to spiritual education. Did you know before this country became the United States of America about 227, 228 years ago, education was a privilege for rich kids? Did you know that? If you were of a poor family, you know what kind of education you got? You know what you got? You learned a trade. You sawed logs, or you learned how to blacksmith, or you got out here and grubbed ditches, or whatever the case might be. Most people in this country were illiterate. They didn't even know how to read or write. Okay? By the way, is it great to be able to read and write? I don't think I'm talking to illiterate people in this room, right? What if you lived your life and you couldn't read or write to the day you died? How would you function? I did not know it, but Phyllis and I had a grandfather, Granddaddy Stevens. And a cousin of ours told me after Granddaddy Stevens died that he couldn't read or write to the day he died. I didn't know that. I thought all my grandparents could read or write. Granddaddy Stevens couldn't read or write to the day he died. And he drove a car. And my question was, how did he pass the written test and ultimately the driver's test to get his license? And the answer was, he didn't have a license. That's the answer. Well, how did he keep from getting stopped by the police? He took the back roads. And he was very careful. You're kidding me. My granddaddy? My granddaddy would do that to the day he died. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay. All of a sudden, education is open to the masses. Rich, poor, it don't matter. Your tax dollars pay for your education. What should all children, starting from kindergarten on up, think about being able to be given an education paid by tax dollars? What should they think? This is a privilege to help me get a better life. Isn't that what they should be thinking? Because, by the way, don't get an education, and guess what job you're going to get? You're going to be back there in the poor around 1770, whatever, grubbing ditches, or in our country, you might make minimum wage flipping hamburgers somewhere. By the way, is it a pretty established fact that the better your education and the better your skill level, the better the pay of your job? Shake or not. In this country, yes, it is. And sometimes it's not so much what you know as who you know. Who got you in to get you this job? But if you don't have the skills to do it, you're pretty much not going to get that job. Okay? Education is a privilege. How many students, particularly high school students, consider education a privilege? How many students do you know in high school had rather you tear the school building down and let us all work on our athletic feats? Heard a comment the other day, is talking about these two comedians, and one of them said, do we have a stadium? And the guy said, yes. He said, do we have a college campus? He said, yes. He said, well, we can't afford to finance both of them. Let's tear down the college. What's the point he's making? If we got to get rid of one of them, which one are we going to get rid of? We're going to get rid of academics. Why? Because we're not going to get rid of athletics. Why are colleges not going to get rid of athletics? It's this right here. Money. You make money off of this. Particularly football. Football. It's cash cow of a lot of these colleges. And matter of fact, cash cow of high schools. I remember going to an East Limestone meeting, PTO meeting, and I remember the person getting up and talking about how much money was in the education fund for East Limestone. I was appalled at how little money there was for the East Limestone school system. Then I talked to somebody who was a part of the quarterback club of the East Limestone High School. And there was no shortage of money in the quarterback club account. It was five figures in the quarterback club. Five figures. And we got a guy running for governor that says, we need an education lottery. Let me tell you something. We got money for education in the athletic department. Shake or not. By the way, I'm not running for office. Sports is extracurricular. That's what it used to be called. Extracurricular. You can get rid of extracurricular and get an education. Did you know that? But But you can run that football across that goal line 100 times and set every high school record. If you can't sign the name on the back of your paycheck, something's wrong with that picture. And there are pro football athletes make an X on the back of their check just so they can cash this multi-$1,000 check that they get for playing on a Saturday or a Sunday or whatever. Something wrong with this picture. By the way, have you ever studied the downfall of the Roman Empire? Y'all ever studied that? I'm going to tell you, we headed down that road. And I'm not talking about the United States of America. The whole world's gone sports crazy. Now, am I against sports? Did I play basketball, Phyllis? Did I play on the golf team in high school? Okay. I played sports. Let me tell you something. Number one priority, if your kid's an athlete, is church. Y'all got that? Is church. God first. If your child has to practice on a Wednesday and you ain't got time to get them home to get them a bath, bring them in their pig, filthy, grubby uniform to Bible class. By the way, we got a facility here now. We've actually got a room down here with a shower in it. You can bring your child's clean clothes and let them shower here at the building. If you don't know where that is, I'll show you where that shower is. It's down there in the office wing. There's no excuse for somebody not bringing their child to church with clean clothes in tow by which they could clean up here at the building and be in that Sunday school class. By the way, how many of y'all regret being in Sunday school class all your life? You regret all that, right? In the day of judgment, who's going to regret having been in Sunday school class? Who's going to regret that? Who is going to regret it in the day of judgment when they don't know what's in this book right here? By the way, I'm preaching to the wrong crowd, right? Wednesday night crowd? Okay. But what I want you to do is help me get these other folks to see what we're talking about here. And by the way, that was the last one on the list. So time caught us on the constraints, but we'll try to hit some. There's one other while they're just coming in. When you die, now this is a teenager now, when you die, do you go to heaven or do you go to the Hadean realm? But Ken Butterworth's here. Our brotherhood has never had a question like that, has Brother Butterworth? Okay. Brother Gus Nichols believed you went straight to heaven. You didn't go to the Hadean realm waiting the day of judgment. You went straight to be with the Lord. And others in the brotherhood, including myself, believe you go to the Hadean realm and you don't go to heaven until the day of judgment when you get your reward in heaven. And then hell, Gehenna, is where the lost go. I believe you go to the Hadean realm. You go to paradise as a Christian. You go to Tartarus or torments if lost, awaiting the day of judgment. Therefore, then, the eternal abode, heaven, and then the eternal abode of the condemned, Gehenna. But anyway, these kids want to know. Another question sometimes people ask is, will you know one another after you're dead? How many of y'all curious about that? I had a person here that had a death of a family member wanted to know, will I ever recognize my family member after they're dead after I die? The answer is yes. Okay, because Lazarus, the beggar, when he died, recognized Abraham, and he'd never met Abraham a day in his life. Abraham had been dead hundreds of years before Lazarus the beggar ever died. He's in Abraham's bosom. Okay? Anyways, a lot of curiosity questions, but we'll come back to this.